So after a week's break, we're back with two parshas, Tazria and Metzora, and as we'll see, quite a bit to say about that. So of course, the central theme of these two parshas is Tzara'as, its various causes, and its details. But at the beginning of Tazria, we have a short perek, and it relates to the halachas of childbirth, and among them we have the mitzvah of mila, as the pasuk says. It's in Perek Yud Beis, pasuk Gimel, uvayom hashmini, on the eighth day, yumol besar oloso. The mitzvah of mila is on the eighth day. Now, although this seems to be a reiteration of sorts, perhaps a repetition, in the sense that we already know about the mitzvah of mila. It has been presented and described or discussed at quite some length in Parshas Lech Lecha. Almost everything we know about mila was said to Avraham Avinu. And that's where all the details are. What therefore is learn from what seems to be a repetition in our parsha of the mitzvah of mila on the eighth day? The Gemara in Masechet Shabbos and Daf Kuf Lamed Hey explains that from the emphasis uvayom hashmini, on the eighth day, we learn a special halacha, and that is that even if the eighth day is on Shabbos, and one might think for a whole host of reasons that perhaps the mila would be itself considered a malacha, maybe it is, to which end we need to be told by the pasuk that nonetheless the mila takes place as we know that it does take place on Shabbos. That is the message from this reiteration of the mitzvah of mila on the eighth day. Uvayom hashmini afilu b'Shabbos. Interestingly, in case we would be moved to ask the follow-up question, why does this detail of mila come so much later? In other words, we've heard an additional message, but why were all the mila-related messages not relayed at once? To this, the Or HaChaim HaKadosh replies very simply that Hashem is not going to communicate to Avram that the mitzvah of mila applies even if the eighth day is on Shabbos, when Avram Avinu doesn't have the mitzvah of Shabbos yet. I mean, the only mitzvah that Avram received directly as an obligation from Hashem is mila. We have a tradition that Avram kept all of the mitzvahs on a voluntary basis. The Mishnah says in the end of Maseches Kiddushin, that may well be. But certainly he doesn't need to be informed that it's okay to do the mitzvah of mila, even if it's on Shabbos. There is no mitzvah of Shabbos as an obligation for Avram. And therefore, we needed to wait until Shabbos became a concern, which it did with the giving of the Torah, for us then to have a follow-up detail within the mila that it applies even on Shabbos. So this is the message from that pasuk at the beginning of our parsha. Now, there is a famous question which is voiced and raised by numerous Rishonim. We know that there are certain mitzvahs where, when they fall on Shabbos, so the on a Torah level, the mitzvah applies, but the Rabbanon, the Chachamim, suspended the mitzvah. Well-known examples of this are Rosh Hashanah, the first day of Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, we don't blow the shofar. The first day of Sukkot falls on Shabbos, we don't take Lulav and Esrog. And the reason famously is given, Shema Yavirenu Arba Amos Birshus Harabim. The person may come to carry. Now, of course, it is applied across the board, even where there's an Eruv, etc., as we know. This is the famous protective measure of the Rabbanon against carrying on Shabbos. So that Rishonim ask a disarming question. Why is it that when the eighth day of from the birth falls on Shabbos, why does the bris go through? Why do the Rabbanon equally not apply this protective measure. I mean, there's no shortage of things that one would need to carry that need to be in the same place, many more than the arba minim, many more than the shofar. Why is the concern of carrying on Shabbos not grounds enough to suspend that mitzvah as surely as they suspended other Torah mitzvahs, which fell on Shabbos, shofar and lulav? It's a very interesting question. Of course, we know it's not so. I mean, the bris takes place. But why is it so? And although many answers were given in the Rishonim, I'd like to focus on a classic answer that's given by one of the early Acharonim. That is the Turei Zahav. Rabbi David Halevi, the Taz, in his commentary, Turei Zahav to Shulchan Aruch, he says this, I think, in no less than four places throughout his commentary on the various sections of Shulchan Aruch. And it's a major yisod, certainly worthwhile contemplating and reflecting on. We know that the Rabbanan have a mandate and the capacity and even the obligation, where relevant, to add protective measures to the Torah. As the Gemara expounds based on the Pasuk in next week's Parsha, Ushmartem es mishmarti, asu mishmeres le mishmarti. You need to make a protective measures, asu siag la Torah. That's one of the first things that is mentioned in Pirkei Avos. However, seeing as that authority and that mandate is given to them by the Torah, it has to work in tandem with the Torah, which means that the Torah gives its mitzvos and also gives, alongside of that, gives the chachamim the capacity to make protective measures regarding those mitzvos. But that's in the interests of the Torah. That's furthering the message of the Torah, so that it has to be working in league with the Torah and can never be considered or in a position that is categorically at odds with the Torah. Now, what does that mean? That might sound a little abstract. It has two expressions, which I hope will be crystal clear. Firstly, says the Taz, that whereas the Chachamim may suspend a mitzvah in certain circumstances, in certain specific situations, they would never enact some measure to suspend the mitzvah entirely, in totality, because that would place them categorically at odds with the Torah, because the Torah says, do this mitzvah, and the Rabbanan say, never. But they can say sometimes no, but they can never say never. What is an illustration of this idea, of this qualification? Again, another seemingly disarming question. As we mentioned before, when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, we don't blow shofar. Why? There's a concern that a person may come to do the malacha of carrying, you can't carry on Shabbos. Ask certain mefarshim, you know, we never sound musical instruments or have them on Shabbos. That's a Rabbanan also enacted a measure that you should not use musical instruments. On your average Shabbos or Yom Tov, a shofar is muktzah. Why? Because you may come to fix it. You may come to shema yitakin klishir. And if somehow some problem arises with it and you adjust it and you fix it, that would be a problem of makkah bepatish. That's a malacha. So actually using a musical instrument of which shofar is included is always osur on Yom Tov. So that leads us to a very interesting question. Namely, how can you ever blow the shofar? Or to put it slightly differently, what happens when Rosh Hashanah falls on Yom Tov? Which, of course, it always does, because it's a Yom Tov. That means that every Yom Tov carries with it the concern for which reason you wouldn't blow the shofar. So it should never be allowed if you're worried about the malacha. Why did they suspend it only when Rosh Hashanah fell on Shabbos for fear of carrying and not always for fear of repairing? Says the Turei Zahav, the question is the answer. In other words, because to take note of the, if you'll pardon the expression, to take note of the concern that you may come to repair the shofar, it would necessarily then involve in suspending the mitzvah completely. You could never blow the shofar, and that would place the Rabbanon at odds with the Torah, categorically, because the Torah says blow the shofar, and the Rabbanon say you can never blow the shofar. That is an impossible situation. The only acceptable situation is if the Torah stated generally blow the shofar, and the Rabbanon say generally yes, just in this particular case when it falls on Shabbos, then no. So this already is an example of the first type of situation where the Chachamim can never be at odds with the general message of the Torah. But that brings us to our case, says the Taz. Because sometimes, even in a specific situation, the Rabbanon will not suspend the mitzvah. Namely, if the Torah itself has addressed that specific situation. And that's what has happened in our case. In other words, when it comes to shofar, what does the Torah say? Blow the shofar in Rosh Hashanah. It's as general as that. It didn't address any specific scenario. There's room for the Rabbanon to come in and say, well, on Shabbos, no. Generally, yes, on Shabbos, no. But as we just discovered, when the Torah gives the mitzvah of milah, not only does it say, do milah on the eighth day, there is a special pasuk dedicated to the situation when the eighth day falls on Shabbos. That's our pasuk. So the Torah has addressed this specific situation and said, yes. So the Rabbanan can never come along when the eighth day falls on Shabbos and say no, because the Torah has said yes about the eighth day on Shabbos. That would again place them at categorically at odds with the Torah, and that is the reason, says the Taz, why the Rabbanon never suspended the mitzvah of Milah when it falls on the eighth day, even though they suspended all those other mitzvahs when they fell on the eighth day. It is worthwhile noting that there is one authority who has given this answer already before the Taz, and the Taz didn't see it, because no one saw it. And that is the Me'iri. Rabbeinu Menachem HaMe'iri, one of the great Rishonim, and he has a commentary on all of Shas, on all of the Talmud. But the commentary in total existed only in some private collection, I believe it was called the Parma Collection, and was only really made accessible and discovered, etc., just over 100 years ago. In 1920. Until that time, all you had from the Me'iri were fragments quoted. There was this enormous work on the Gemara which lay untapped, unaccessed. And that led to a very interesting situation, because many of the innovations or of the chidushim or of the ideas that were developed independently by later scholars and later Talmidei Chachamim were subsequently discovered in the Me'iri. It happens very often. Many of the good things in life often end up being Me'iris once it was discovered. And this explanation of the Taz, which is famous as the Taz's idea, whatever the Torah has marked specifically, the Rabbanan can never suspend, is actually to be found in the Me'iri. That's worthwhile noting. Just one final point, a PS on this idea, while we're already talking about this, and also this will be for us a bit of tashlumin on a parsha that we missed out. According to some commentaries, this idea can be found in Rashi, in the very beginning of Shas, literally page 1. What is the beginning of the Shas? The time for the evening mitzvah of Shema. More correctly, the time for the mitzvah of evening Shema. And very briefly, just to get to the point that we wish to get to, although the mitzvah in principle applies the whole night, the Rabbanan pulled that time back until Chatzos. And the thinking behind this, as explained by the Gemara, is very often, if you think you have the whole night, before you look around, it's morning. So in order to remind people or advise people that they're on the clock, the Chachamim said you have until Chatzos. If you know that you only have half the night, you're more likely to do the mitzvah in that first half. If you think you have the whole night, you'll take a bit of a snooze, and snooze will need to snooze. Mitzvah gereres mitzvah, and before you look around, higi hazman kriya shema shel shachris, to quote the Pesach Haggadah. And therefore, they had this stricture of the first night. And the Mishnah proceeds to mention a number of other mitzvahs, which are nighttime mitzvahs, but and you have the whole night in principle. The Rabbanan pulled it back until Chatzos, halfway through. One of those mitzvahs is the burning of korbanos. Hekter chalovim ve'evarim. Okay. Rashi there says that as much as the rabbis made this stricture of until Chatzos with regards to nighttime mitzvahs generally, but this mitzvah of burning the korbanos, they never suspended it. They never restricted it to Chatzos. You have the whole night. And everyone wants to know where Rashi gets this from. Why would he see this mitzvah as being different than the other mitzvahs? It's mentioned together with them. We have a principle. On a Torah level, you have the whole night. The Rabbanan pulled it back till Chatzos. Why? What did Rashi see in this mitzvah to maintain that it's different than the others and there's no restriction of Chatzos? Says the Prima Godim in his commentary, Rosh Yosef, to the beginning of Brachos there, the answer is in the Pasuk. Because if you look at the beginning of Parshas Tzav, not too long ago, Perek Vav, Pasuk Beis. We'll read the Pasuk and all will be clear. Tzav es Aharon ve'es banav lemor. Command Aaron, his son, saying, Zos Torah Ha'ola, this is the law of the Ola, of the burnt offering. Hi Ha'ola, it's the Ola, Al Mokta, on the pyre, Al Mizbeach, on the Mizbeach, Kol Halayla Ad Haboker, the whole night until the morning. Those words are said about the mitzvah of burning korbanos. Kol Halayla Ad Haboker, the whole night until the morning. Says the Prima Godim, that's why Rashi said that the rabbis never pulled it back to Chatzos. All of the other mitzvahs, they're nighttime mitzvahs. So the Torah says, this happens at night. What part of the night? Didn't specify. So the rabbis, in the interest of encouraging you to do the mitzvah, can make their restrictions. But the exception was this mitzvah of burning the korbanos. The Torah didn't say it happens at night. It said it happens all night until morning. There's no maneuverability with that. There's nothing you can do with that. The whole night has been cleared explicitly by the Torah for this mitzvah. The rabbis will never say a word otherwise. And that's what's behind this exception in Rashi. So it's very interesting to see that later Mefarshim will discuss the idea of the Taz at length. But according to some, it has been in Rashi's commentary from page one of Shas. Okay, so that's an important, or at least the highlights, some highlights from the important concept of the Taz. And with that in mind, we move on to the central theme of the Parsha, which is Tzaraas. And that's introduced in Perek Yud Gimel, okay, the first Perek of the Parsha, Perek Yud Beis. It's just 8 psukim long, and it discusses Torah Seyoledes. And then we get down to the Tzaraas business in Perek Yud Gimel. And Pasuk Beis says as follows. Adam, a person, ki yeb or b'saro, if he has in the skin of his flesh, se'es o sapachas o vaheras. Now these terms are hard to translate. A one-word translate, because they're different types of white. And this type of white, and bright white, and off-white, and dimmer white, and so on. Vayaba or basarola nega tzaras, and it will be in the skin of his flesh as nega tzaras. Now, the laws and details of tzaras have a reputation for being quite complex. And we're not going to go into those different colorations per se. But in addition to denoting or connoting different shades of white, these three terms also have a message for us that lies at the heart of what Tzaraas is all about. And let us see how that is. If you were to give a one-word answer to the question, or there could only give one answer to the question, what brings about saras? And interestingly, the Torah does not say this explicitly, not here and even not later on. It implies it, but we have traditions about this, and we know if there's one thing that is likely to cause saras, it's going to be lashon hara, slander and gossip. So what leads to saras? Lashon hara. But now, we've only really done half the work, and in a sense, maybe the easier half. Because the question remains, and what leads to lashon hara? Because if we never address that question, it's hard to stop it from happening. And there's room to say that there are three primary drivers or motivators for a person to speak lashon hara of one form or another about another person. It's interesting. It generally doesn't lead to material gain or a physical pleasure in that way, but there's something about it that makes it appealing. Where does it appeal? Where does that lie? The first possibility could be that it's an issue of one-upmanship. As we know, and Koheles has informed us, that what lies behind most interpersonal relationships is what's called, or lies behind them, or resides within them, is the concept of kinas ish mere'ehu. The dynamic of one person vis-a-vis the other. Who's alpha, who's beta, who's on top, who ascends? Mi yarum, mi shafelu, mi yarum. That's what it's all about. And for a person standing vis-a-vis others is extremely important. It can really, people do a great deal in order to preserve that, in order to defend it. There's a famous question that was asked by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. You know, anyone who's ever visited a Beis Din, you see the type of tensions run high in a Din Torah, and people will defend their positions, and it can often get very fraught. But what's interesting is, the very same person who causes such a ruckus in the Beis Din over a Din Torah, you know, if he has a shayla in Treifus, so he'll come to the Rav, and if the Rav says it's no good, he'll throw it out. And sometimes even incurring more of a loss than the amount that he's debating the Din Torah. But the extent to which he's lost the Din Torah, that money is treif for him. It's treif like the chicken was treif. So why is a person so accepting of a psak in matters of kashrus, not so much in matters of choshen mishpat? And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said the answer is very simple. Because when it comes to a Din Torah and choshen mishpat, you don't just lose. You lose to the other guy. You lose to someone else. You lose and they win. In the question of kashrus, you lose to a chicken. Or maybe you and the chicken both lose. But no one wins. So there hasn't been some new upset in the balance of power, which people are so protective of. And that's how the very same person will react so differently in those situations. That's the first very, very formidable factor that can lead to lashon hara, just to preserve my status as being up there and keeping everyone else down there, or at least plony down there where he belongs. Secondly, a second motivator can be the desire for social acceptance. Because if you have the gossip on someone and that's news and it's nice and that can get you in with other people, and it will make your people will listen to you. And social acceptance, again, is also a powerful driver. And finally, if you have insight into someone, if you know things about someone, so that places you as a knowledgeable person, and people like to be perceived as knowledgeable. All of these three things, each one alone can bring a person to lashon hara. Sometimes they work in combinations of two or all three. And they are expressed in the different types of tsaras that a person can receive. How so? Let's go back to those terms. What is the first type of white called? It's called se'es. And what does se'es mean? It means elevation. It, like ram v'nisa, kisisa. because a person is looking for se'es, he's looking for ascension. He's looking to place himself up there and keep everyone else down here. And that such an attitude can give him the symptom, which is called, the type of tzaraas called se'es. What is the second? The second term is called sapachas. And what does sapachas mean? Sefach or nisbach is to be joined together with other things. Safiach are things that are joined together in packs. and so too, here's a person, he's looking for safiach. He's looking for a connection with other people, and this will get him his in. But that will lead him to tzaraas called sapachas. And finally, the third type is called baheres. And baheres, of course, from the word bahir, enlightened, illuminated. Here's a person who wishes to show how enlightened they are, how illuminated they are vis-a-vis the other person, to the extent that they start discussing their faults. And thus, although, again, from the halacha, and the halacha remains the halacha, which needs to be looked into, this type of white and that type of white, but in terms of avoidance, these three terms, se'es, sapachas, and baheres, are all reminders for a person of what could lead them to down this road in the first place of Lashon Hara that would bring upon them tzaraas. Se'es, sapachas, and baheres. And I think there's room perhaps to add to this idea, because the punishment, the affliction of tzaraas, the way the Pasuk describes it is or bisaro, the skin of his flesh, which is interesting because people, I think, only really have skin of their flesh. I mean, that's where they are. So the term or bisaro is very much emphasizing the external nature of this punishment. It's on the outermost part of the person. It's on the most external and visible part of the person. But why? Why is that being emphasized? Because the Torah isn't just telling us these are the three things that could motivate a person to Lashon Hara. It's also telling us that whatever gains a person might feel that they will attain through speaking Lashon Hara in these three areas is itself only skin deep. It's only true on an external level. Meaning the Torah isn't just saying it's morally wrong. It's also flawed, because it is only on the most external level that these things would be attained anyway, but not on any inner or real way. Why is that so? If we go through them again, 1, 2, 3, one by one. So the first is se'es. Here's a person, he's looking to establish it, to assert himself as being higher than the other person. But of course, as we know, a person is never really truly higher than someone else until they don't need to establish it. In other words, a real mila, a real level that you have, lahavdil or lamashal more correctly, someone who's really rich never really needs to show how rich they are. It's only if they're a wannabe or a contender, they need to show that they're more of a gvir than the other person. But the real gvir doesn't really need to show anyone. And which means, in a sense, that when the person doth protest too much about the other person's faults, that means that he isn't really that much better than them. It is a skin-deep attainment of ascension. Secondly, sapachas, looking for acceptance. But again, the acceptance can never be more than external, than superficial. It can never be a real connection with other people based on Lashon Hara. Because the very basis of his acceptance is that he has shown that he is prepared to be gossiping and slandering other people. Well, that's hardly going to be an impetus for others to accept him totally into their group, because they've seen what he's capable of. He's brought his credentials that he will turn on other people. So why will he not turn on them? They'll always be kept at arm's length. There will always be an element of suspicion. A real connection can never be formed. Only a skin-deep connection. And once again, that's sapachas. And finally, baheres. He wishes to show how much he knows, how enlightened he is vis-a-vis the other person. But anyone who really knows that they can never know. exactly what is going on with someone else. In other words, you only know what you see, but if you're a superficial person, then what you see is the totality of what there is. But if you're a deeper person, you understand, no, it's only the outer skin of what there is. So that his very propensity to show how wise he is by defining a person by what he sees shows that he only really has an extrinsic or an external way of viewing things. So once again, I think this is almost like a follow-up message. Having identified the things that would lead a person to Lashon Hara, the Torah then shows, even then, the punishment shows it was wrong, and it was not only was it wrong in moral terms, it was wrong in terms of what you thought that you would gain from it. So these, I think, are important messages from Tzaraas from the very beginning, literally from the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel. It is also true that there are different types of tzaraas. As we move a little bit deeper into further into the parsha, so at the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel, you have tzaraas of the body. Later on, you'll have what's called tzaraas harosh, tzaraas of the head, and that's to be found in pasuk mem. If we take a look, we've skipped over a number of psukim, but if we see mem to mem dalet is basically the concept of tzaraas harosh. And again, there's many details, but how does it begin? Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Mem, V'ish ki yemaret rosho, ki reachu, if it's like a sudden loss of hair in a particular part of the head, and it goes on in the front and the back and so on and so forth, and other different discolorations, all the details that go into tzaraas can also take place within the head. And Pasuk Mem Dalet says, Ish Tsaruahu, if these things really are symptoms of Tuma, of an actual Tsaras, he's Ish Tsarua, Tomihu, and he's Tomi, he's impure, Tamei Tamenu HaKohen, the Kohen will pronounce him as Tomi, Barosho Nigo, the affliction is in his head. Meshechochma addresses a simple question. And that is that until this point, and this has to be the third or fourth type of tzaraas that's been discussed so far in the parsha, the tzaraas of clothing and other such things. And until this point, if someone is, let's call it tzaraas positive, the way that the parsha describes it is always very directly by saying, it's tzaraas. Tzaraas who? Or sometimes tzaraas he. And the Balkuri has to know which is which. But the verdict is always given in terms of, is it tzaraas or is it not? Yes or no? For the first time, when it comes to tzaraas of the head, Pasuk Mem Dalet doesn't say it's tzaraas. It says he is ish tzarua. This person is a person with tzaraas, which is interesting because it just sounds like another way of saying the same thing. If it's tzaraas, then he's a person with tzaraas. But we never had this before, ish tzarua. It's always been the focus on the tzaraas itself. And Meshech Chochma explains that if we understand that tzaraas is coming, even broadly, with the concept of midah keneged midah, measure for measure, so you've got to understand that there's a difference whether a person's, the tzaraas affliction, is it in a person's body or in their head. Because although we flag Lashon Hara as the prime cause for tzaraas, the Gemara mentions a number of causes and the Medrash mentions others, and some of them are bad practices, things that are wrong, but they're more a person giving into desires that, or acting in a way no different in a sense than an animal would act in terms of doing the wrong thing. And for those types of things, tzaraas comes on the body because the body of a person is like the body of an animal. But then tzaraas of the head is then different. It's not just a different location. It's a different categorization. It's a different type of problem that would lead a person to tzaraas of the head. Tzaraas of the head comes from things that are not right in the person's head. which are either corrupt or objectionable attitudes or perspectives or those types of things which the way people think. And for that type of dysfunctional head behavior or intellectual behavior or perception behavior, that would result of tsaras in the head. And interestingly, we have a case of this very idea in the Tanakh, because the Navi, it describes Uzziah HaMelech. Uzziah was one of the kings of Yehuda, and the pasuk itself says that he became very haughty and arrogant, as a result of which, in punishment for which, tsaras began to appear on his forehead. Says Meshech Chochma, that's the punishment fits the crime. In other words, haughtiness for a person is about self-perception. It's about the way that he relates to himself and others, his view of things and how he thinks about things, and therefore a corruption in that area of the person led to tsaras of the head. So, says Meshech Chochma, so now we understand why it is only with regards to tsaras of the head you see the attention to detail in the psukim. It's only with regard to tsaras of the head that the pasuk talks about him as a tsaras person, ish tsarua, because all the other types of tsaras until now, they've been about shortcomings that could exist within an animal. Of course, they're wrong for a human being to have them, but that they don't yet address the aspect of the person that makes him uniquely an ish. And therefore, the verdict is simply, it's yes, tsaras, or not tsaras. However, when you get to tsaras of the head, it's the head that defines the person, the intellect that a person has, that makes him uniquely human. A corruption there means not just that we're dealing with a case of tsaras, you're dealing with a case of an ish tsarua. This is a tsaras person. The very domain that makes him an ish has also been corrupted by tsaras, which is more of a condemnation. It's very interesting to see how this idea resonates in a parallel discussion that takes place in the Chofetz Chaim. Of course, the Chofetz Chaim wrote and spoke at length about matters of Lashon Hara, and he directs our attention to the well-known pasuk in Tehillim, Mi Ya'isha Chofetz Chaim, Oyev Yamim Neros Tov, who wants life? And the answer is, the response is, the antidote, Netzor Lashon Chamira, that's the way forward. Netzor Lashon Chamira, Svasecha Midaber Mirma, to guard your tongue against bad and deceit. And the Chofetz Chaim asks the question, Mi Ha'isha Chofetz Chaim? Once again, we see the resonance here. Is the word ish not redundant? What if it said, Mi Ha'chafetz Chaim? Who wants life? In fact, for what it's worth, but often it's illustrative, when we translate that pasuk, I think we would naturally drop the word ish in our presentation, which is often a good marker for whether it deserves attention as potentially being redundant. We would say, who wants life? We wouldn't say, who is the man who wants life, if you didn't have to translate literally. So what is the word ish coming to add? Mia isha chafetz chayim, says the Chofetz Chaim. We can see from very early on that what the faculty or the expressive faculty that makes a person unique is the power of speech. We know that other animals are capable of communicating, and I don't wish to be accused of any kingdomist statements in this regard. We know that dolphins can blip and so on and so forth. But in terms of expressing ideas, so that is a uniquely human faculty. And where do we see this for the first time? In Parshas Bereishis itself. Because in Perek Beis, when it describes in more detail how man came to be, and the pasuk says that Hashem took dirt from the ground and breathed into it, Vayipach ba'afav nishmas chaim, and breathed life into it, the combination of that divine breath and dirt was Vayehi ha'adam le'nefesh chaya. Man became a living soul, nefesh chaya. It is fascinating to consult the words of Unculus on those two words, nefesh chaya. Unculus is a translation. But what does he say on the words nefesh chaya? Ruach memalala. A speaking spirit. A speaking being. That is Unculus' translation of nefesh chaya, because the unique combination of body and soul, the type of body that a person has, specifically combined with the type of soul that a human being has, is what expresses itself in ruach memalala. It's very interesting, just as an aside, but impossible to pass over. The Maharal, in his in the Sefer Gevuras Hashem, explains that, again, very similar in this regard, it's the unique combination of body and soul that breeds the power of speech. And says Maharal, with this in mind, we can understand on a deeper level, perhaps on a fundamental level, a very well-known statement of Chazal. The Gemara says in Maseches Nida that before someone is born, they learn the whole Torah. They know the whole Torah, whatever that means, but they know it. They've got it. However, they don't retain it. Because when they're born, as the Gemara describes it, an angel comes, taps them on the mouth, and they forget it all. Of course, there was value in them knowing it because they have a propensity for it. It can be reclaimed, but they forget it all. Says Maharal, how does being tapped on the mouth, or how does being hit on the mouth make a person forget anything? I mean, without putting too fine a point on it. I mean, if it, you know, a blow to the head can cause a person to forget things. To be hit on the mouth, I've never heard anyone who says, you know, I was hit on the mouth and that's the last thing I remember. You certainly remember the one who hit you on the mouth. So what does the Gemara mean? Says Maharal. When the Gemara says that the unborn child knows the entire Torah, it's not referring, with all due respect, that it's not referring to the fetus in the womb. The fetus in the womb is effectively pure physical being. It is animated to a degree, of course, it's with full accord, but it doesn't yet have the soul. The soul yet is in the higher realms. It's not the fetus in the womb that learns Torah. It's the soul that has not yet been put into the child's body. That's what's learning Torah. And it's able to access the totality of Torah because it's unrestricted by physical existence. And then something happens. The child is born. And when the child is born, the body and the soul become fused. It's the trauma of the fusion of the soul into with the newborn child, its introduction into the body of the newborn child, that's what causes it to forget its learning. What's that got to do with being tapped on the mouth? Says Maharal, because we have said that the power of speech is a product of the union of the body and the soul. So when they become unified, that's when the power of speech is installed in the person, and that is the tap on the mouth that he gets from the angel. It's like the Makkah Bepatish installing the power of speech, which is an expression of the fusion of the neshama and the guf, of the body and the soul. But it's the fusion itself, that experience, the trauma, that experience that causes the child to forget his Torah. Achar hadvarim ha'eleh, that's a very, very important way of understanding that well-known Gemara of what happens before the child is born, once the child is born. But now we understand, says Chafetz Chaim, why we say, mi ha'ish ha'chafetz chayim. Who is the man who desires life? Because what it boils down to is protecting the way you speak. But your speech is what defines you as a person. Once again, we see how this dovetails together with the Meshech Chochma. For the Meshech Chochma, it's in the head, in the sense of your abstract intellect defines you as a person. That's expressed in the power of speech. And therefore, a person who wishes to protect their status as an ish, as a human being, should netzol shon chameira. That's where the David HaMelech calls to them, as ish, miha ish ha'chafetz chayim, if you wish to be worthy of the title of Ish, protect the faculty that defines you as such. And it's very interesting to note in this regard that one of the korbanos, again, to the extent that we can tap in a little bit to the language of the korbanos, so one of the korbanos that is brought by the metzora upon his recovery is an asham, a guilt offering. And it's not hard for us to understand why. I mean, he is guilty. He's guilty of speaking lashon hara. And there is such a concept, and it has to be recognized. It's very interesting. I think it's worth noting that guilt is considered to be a very Jewish idea. I mean, Jewish mothers specifically, but a very Jewish idea. And in a sense, it is, but not for the reason that it is often projected as. In other words, the reason, and on the contrary, it is almost like a non-Jewish definition of guilt that's been pasted back onto to Judaism, by which I mean Judaism does highlight guilt. It does so as an expression of its confidence that whatever you're guilty of, you can fix. Whatever you have a problem in, you're capable of rising above. And that's why you want to highlight it, because you want to improve anywhere you can, which is everywhere. You want to fix everything you can, which is everything. So in other words, guilt as something that can highlight a shortcoming that can be fixed is indeed a very Jewish idea. Unfortunately, people cut and paste the concept of guilt as its own thing, which cannot be fixed. But that's actually a non-Jewish concept, that guilt can. It's a Christian concept, that guilt cannot be fixed. So it's this often happens, that in a sense, an idea is taken from Judaism, it's emptied out of its Jewish content, filled it with something else, and then put back in Judaism, and then it becomes known in this way as a Jewish idea. Anyway, guilt is certainly one of those things. Back to where we are. So the metzora brings an asham, he brings a guilt offering. Why? Because he's guilty as a metzora. But the sforno, as is so often the case, he compacts these major ideas in just a few words. The sforno says the true understanding of the asham, of the guilt offering of the metzora, is that it is a sub-branch of another type of asham, another guilt offering. Namely, Asham Me'ila, the guilt offering of Me'ila. What is Me'ila? As we know, there are certain things that belong to the Beis HaMikdash, temple property, consecrated property. If a person would use them for mundane purposes, would misuse them or and such like, would miscarry them, that's called Me'ila. To use something holy for mundane or profane purposes is me'ila. And if a person did it, he needs to bring an asham. And says the sforno, and that's why a metzora needs to bring an asham. Because that's exactly what he's done. He's taken the faculty of speech, which is a holy thing. How many good things can be done through speech? How many people can be brought together? How many grounds for improvement can be expressed, how many truths can be expressed, and so on and so forth. It's a holy thing. The full extent of the wrongdoing of the person who spoke lashon hara is not just that he did a bad thing. He used a holy faculty and profaned it to to speak lashon hara. So when he comes now to rehabilitate himself, he needs to realize that he's committed me'ila. It's an amazing thing. And in a sense, the moral of the story is, and should always be, that the goal is not to say nothing. As true as it is that a person who speaks lashon hara, he's doing the wrong thing with the power of speech. But the moral of the story is not that the ideal is to say nothing at all. But on the contrary, to recognize how speech can be used in order, again, to for so much positivity. So many good things can come from the way that a person speaks, even a short exchange, an encouraging word, or whatever it is, or words of davening, or words of Torah, words of bin adam lechaveiro. That's where a person is. is directed to. He's not to be, the goal is not to be petrified into silence or paralyzed into silence, but on the contrary, the goal is for a person to use this incredible power with only the best, the most positive results in mind. So this is the idea of Miha Ish as it relates to the heart of the person. Maybe just one final thought, and with that we will, I believe, have what to mull over in terms of the messages from the parsha with regards to our lives. We know that again, back to the korbanos of the mitzvah, and we'll start with the halacha, and as halachas go. It's kind of in the corner because it's not practicable for our times. It's in the locus of korbanos, but how much it expresses, as we will see again through Meshech Chachma and further Meshech Chachma, the worlds of halacha and Jewish thought and parshanut are all really parts of the same world ultimately. So when the Mitzvah recovers, he brings three korbanos, and these three korbanos, interestingly, are in the category called Ole V'Yored, which we may have spoken about recently. Briefly, Ole V'Yored means that what you bring as the korban either goes up or down depending on your financial status. Like a Yoledes, for example, and so on and so forth. There are certain types of korbanos. If you can afford it, you bring the more expensive korban, which is the animal itself, and if you can't, then you bring a bird. Ole v'yored. What you bring goes up or down depending on how much you can afford. Now, there's an interesting shaila, which I guess has to be asked, namely, what if a person can afford to bring the animal, but he nevertheless brings the bird? He can afford to bring the grade A korban, but in the end he brings the grade B, sukbet, or whatever, for the poorer person. Has he fulfilled his obligation? At least after the fact. And interestingly, the answer is yes, generally, with the exception of Mitzvah. Because the Torah, and how does Parshas Mitzvah begin? Zos tihye Torah haMitzvah. This is the law for Mitzvah. The emphasis on this is how it is means whatever he needs to bring, it's got to be like that. Right? It has to be Zos and none other. And if he brings something else, he has not fulfilled his obligation. It's an interesting anomaly. Just to summarize what we've just said and put it into one sentence. In these korbanos that have more expensive and less expensive, if you could afford the more expensive, but nonetheless you bring the less expensive, for most other Ole V'Yored rates, you fulfilled your obligation, not for Mitzvah. Why not? Says Meshech Chachma again, because one of the primary causes that relates to, or that leads to Tzaras, and we're discovering quite a few, and there are more than one, is what's called Tzaras Ayin. Tzaras Ayin, miserliness, stinginess. That's why when a person gets tzaras on the house, for example, see, he comes to the Kohen, the way that the Pasuk describes him is Uba Asher Lo Habayis, the one that the house is his. He comes to the Kohen and says, I think I have a problem. Why does the Pasuk emphasize the one whose house is his? Because that's part of the problem, says the Gemara in Maseches Yuma, that the house is his, it's for him and for him alone. He doesn't share anything with anyone, there's no room for anyone, there's nothing in there for anyone. Asher lo habayis. That's how he's described, because that's really where the problem is. And it's for that reason, says Meshech Chachma, that when you purify the house and blood is sprinkled on the house, the Pasuk doesn't say where on the house it's sprinkled, but the Teras Kohanim says, on the lintel of the front door, because that's the door that no one was allowed to pass through. That's where the problem starts. So Tzaras Ayin miserliness can lead to tzaras of the house, but it can also lead to tzaras of the person. And now, says Meshech Chochma, we understand why the korbanos of Metzora, you see how the worlds of halacha and of machshava, of Jewish thought and ideals, are blending together. We now understand the halachic anomaly. Why is it that with other ole v'yoreds, if you bought the less expensive option, you're yotzei after the fact, but not for a metzora? Says Meshech Chochma, because if a metzora does that, it means he hasn't been cured. Because what brought him to tzaras in the first place? He's stingy. He's miserly. He's always looking for the cheapest option. So if he does that with the korban that's meant to rehabilitate him, so then he has brought the problem into the solution. And that's not a solution at all. And that is why the halacha states, if you're a metzora and you can afford it, do not go for the cheap option. Not in this. And maybe rethink the way that you're using your assets generally in life. Because that's the resounding message from the korbanos of Metzora. And so we've seen quite a few items this evening, beginning with the more halachic discussion of the Taz, which is a major principle, what the Torah explicitly permitted. Chazal have a different relationship with that in terms of restrictive measures. And then we move from there to Tzaras, to Se'es, and Sapafas, and Baheres, three skin-deep motivations for Tzaras. And then from Tzaras of the body to Tzaras of the head, that's where the ish resides, in the power of speech, that's where the ish is. And from there to the issues of Tzaras Ayin, as related to Tzaras of the house and Tzaras of the person. Plenty of food for thought, I submit. And we'll leave it there for this evening. Meet again next week. I wish you all a good night and a wonderful week ahead. All the very best.